Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. 4th of July weekend, lots going on. Family reunions. We're going to check in with a couple of big ones in a few minutes. But also lawmakers heading home. And with a sour economy, new numbers today show unemployment has dropped. But that's mainly people who've given up looking. And that oil crisis. The Mobile Press Register reports that oil has now been spotted on all 32 miles of Baldwin County beaches in Alabama. Plus, you have immigration, the change at the top in Afghanistan. What kind of a reunion can politicians expect with their voters? Let's take a scan across country with NPR's political junkie, Ken Rudin. Ken, welcome.
Thank you, Robin.
It's also always a pleasure to speak with you. You say, don't forget war funding. Talk a little bit about what's on your radar.
Well, everything you just mentioned, and it's not a happy electorate, and then obviously the lawmakers going home, the Senate's already out, and the lawmakers going home for the July 4th break are not likely to get a happy reception from anybody. We've seen Tea Party anger for over a year. Remember those angry town hall meetings that we saw Arlen Specter badgered last summer. That anger is out there, but there's also unhappiness and uncertainty among Democrats as well. Certainly on the war, the Obama administration is of course going all out to fund the funding for the war in Afghanistan, and there are a lot of Democrats who say this is exactly not why we were elected. This is exactly not what we were supposed to do. It's not much different than the Bush war policy, and after all, you have General Petraeus. Once upon a time, the general betray us of the MoveOn.org crowd, now doing whatever he can to salvage the Obama war policy. So there are a lot of people unhappy on both sides.
Right. Well, let's just tick through. Let's start here in Massachusetts, because there is one politician who is probably going to get a warm embrace when he comes home. He's Republican Senator Scott Brown. And, you know, he seems to be one of those politicians that has caught a wave, and no matter what is surfing it. Boston Globe poll says he's the most popular politician here in Massachusetts, and he's one of the most sought-after votes in Washington. And popular, even though as someone who ran as an independent, he voted with Democrats on financial reform, then voted against it when it added a tax on banks. The Globe's Yvonne Abraham points out he voted against an extension of unemployment benefits, against extra money for the mentally disabled, as we said, against a tax on banks. Gail Collins writes in the New York Times, "We have here a populist man of the people playing the role of friend to the banks while not being particularly helpful to the long-term unemployed. What can I tell you? Maybe it's because he drives a truck." So your sense on Scott Brown, first of all.
Well, he is a fascinating guy, of course. You know, it's not every day we talk about a Republican senator from Massachusetts, Ed Brooke, of course, being the last one, and that's been a long time ago. But Scott Brown, even though, as many people have pointed out, he does have a pretty conservative voting record, and after all, he was campaigning as a conservative, even though, and as an albeit an independent conservative, back in the January 19th special election.
A lot of people here didn't even know he was Republican.
Well, they knew that Martha Coakley was an inept candidate, and that's all that seemed to matter at the time. But that's back in the past. The thing is, even though he has a pretty much conservative record, the fact that he has talked to Democrats, he has talked to Harry Reid, he's shown a willingness to cross party lines. He is a much sought after guy on both sides. You know, we talk about all these senators like Blanche Lincoln in Arkansas, who's being pummeled by the left and pummeled by the right. Scott Brown is actually being, you know, sought after by the left and the right. And he's doing the kind of job that you'd never think of somebody with such little seniority. But with Bob Byrd's death, with the numbers of Democrats down to now 58, Scott Brown, any kind of Republican who might come over is widely sought by the Democratic Party, and that's Scott Brown.
Well, you mentioned Arkansas. Ken Rudin, hold on there 1 second, because we want to bring in John Bromit, political columnist at the Arkansas News. John, Ken mentioned Blanche Lincoln. Of course, she narrowly won her primary bid against a progressive Democrat. She now faces Republican John Boozman in the fall. She, on the other hand, you know, as opposed to some of the things we've been saying about Scott Brown, she's been, you know, deeply trying to do some things to limit, for instance, how banks invest in risky derivatives to sort of respond to the financial crisis. Does anyone there? It was difficult enough in the beginning to understand this stuff. Is anyone still following that there?
I wrote two columns about it this week, and I think I'm trying to think if I got a single reader response.
Yeah, there you go.
It's simply not something that people understand or choose to endeavor to understand. I don't think she moved to the left during the runoff to appear to be anti-Wall Street, and she put in this bill to spin off the derivatives operation. She compromised. It's complicated. It's as to what it did. It's complicated as to whether she won or lost on the issue. One thing she'll not be hearing about on the 4th of July break is derivatives.
Right. What will she hear about, John?
People here are just angry, and it's not about the war. These are conservative people. They're angry about health care reform. They think it's too much spending, too much government control of health care. They've seen nothing yet and won't be seeing anything for a while to disprove that. I think eventually they might. Stimulus spending with unemployment still high. Too much government, too much debt. Obama lost here to McCain by 59-39, and it's not any better now, possibly worse. So Lincoln gets all of the negatives of association with Obama, and then she appears on the other side to be too overly finessing, trying to appear liberal one day and conservative the next. So she's just catching it from every direction.
Boy, somebody get Blanche Lincoln a sparkler. She might need it this weekend.
People be nice to her at the 4th of July traditional picnics. It will be no worse, probably not as bad as the brutal primary she just had that she just won less than a month ago. So whatever she hears this weekend, she will be accustomed to it, I assure you.
John Brommett, political columnist for the Arkansas News. Thanks so much.
Thanks.
Ken Rudin, we're going to turn to Florida in 1 second, but just let's switch to the Gulf. Just briefly, how is this oil spill playing out politically?
Well, of course, again, as John Brumman accurately says, everybody is angry, and they're certainly angry about the oil spill. And the question is, who are they most angry about? Are they angry with BP? Are they angry about the government, the fact that government has not been able to stop it? Or so the contradiction here is so fascinating, because a lot of people don't like, especially Republicans, don't like government intrusion into anything, and certainly not regulation of the oil drilling. And yet when a calamity, and this is definitely beyond a calamity, right, when something like this happens, then they say, where's government? Where's the government role? And it's playing politically on both sides. I mean, Democrats loved Joe Barton apologizing to BP and talking about shakedowns, and that said that proves that the Republican Party is in the hip pocket of big oil. So they had that as somebody to run against. But at the same time, Charlie Crist, who's the governor of Florida, wants a Senate seat there, was against the drilling. Then he was for the drilling because he wanted to be McCain's vice president. Now he's against the drilling again. And for most part, the politicians in the Gulf, in Florida, in Mississippi, in Louisiana, they seem to be profiting.
Well, you know what, Ken, stand by. That's Ken Rudin again, of course, from NPR. Let's bring in Mark Caputo, who covers state politics and policy for the Miami Herald. Mark, you've been listening to Ken. Our sense is that, in fact, Crist has been sort of applauded for his reaction to to the gusher. Your sense of how this is playing out there?
Well, our colleagues Beth Reinhardt and Marilyn Kloss today wrote a story about that very matter. As it looks like Crist, who had foundering poll numbers and was doing so badly in the Republican Party and getting beaten so badly, he actually left the primary to run as an independent. He seems to have kind of righted the ship, and so far, at the very least, he is not enduring the criticisms in handling the oil spill the way Obama has, and perhaps is seeing his poll numbers increase, or looks like his poll numbers are increased. He's showing some separation from Marco Rubio, who is his Republican opponent, who was the front runner in the three-person race. So he seems to be politically benefiting from it. There's nothing odd about that. Jeb Bush, same thing happened 2004, 2005, when he led the state during the back-to-back hurricane seasons out in Louisiana right now. I think the latest Rasmussen poll
shows
Jindal's approval rating is high as well.
If someone can show leadership during a controversy,
show leadership or be seen in a leadership position. People don't underestimate the value of what's called B-roll. That's the video images you see on the nightly news as Brian Williams or whomever is talking. If you just flip on the nightly news, you're invariably going to see Charlie Crist wandering a beach and fretting about oil, and that kind of speaks to people, it appears.
Meanwhile, just if you could, just for a minute, touch on Marco Rubio, who, again, was a surging Republican candidate for U.S. Senate. But then the Arizona law was passed, the anti-immigration law, and, you know, he took a stand against that. But then, of course, a lot of his constituents might also feel the same way, Mark?
Well, he did take a stand against it. Update, he then took a stand for
right.
The reason given was that a change was made to the law which prohibited racial profiling. So he said, so on the whole, it's okay. Understand that our last poll shows that that was very popular in Florida by double digits. Every demographic group appeared to support it except for Hispanics. But Rubio, being an Hispanic, is able to weather any sort of potential negative in supporting a law that's generally viewed by Hispanics in a negative light. So, but, you know, so far with Krista enjoying the benefits of what appear to be the political benefits of the oil spill, if anyone can enjoy benefits from it, Rubio has kind of been drowned out by that. There's also not a competitive Republican primary, so you can't really bash Krist on abortion so much, bash Krist for his associations with Obama, et cetera.
Mark Caputo, he covers state politics and policy for the Miami Herald. Mark, thanks as always.
Sure.
And Ken Rudin, a couple minutes here to just round out the thinking going into the weekend. Of course, we want to say that, you know, we're talking about politics, but of course, most important, our hearts are breaking for the people down in the Gulf as they approach this big weekend with oil, you know, coating their beaches. But scanning the horizon politically, what else are you thinking about? What other hotspot might you be thinking about this weekend, Ken Rudin?
Well, you know, can I just say one quick thing about what Mark said, which is very important? He said that the fact that whether Charlie Crist is doing anything is not the point. The fact that he's being seen everywhere is the point. And I've been arguing from the beginning that what really brought President Bush down, his numbers down, was not so much the unpopularity with the Iraqi war, but the fact is it was Hurricane Katrina and the seemingly inability of the president to show compassion and concern. I think when you have politicians out there who make sure they're seen day in and day out, especially in something horrific as the Gulf spill, that can only help them politically.
Should President Obama be going to the Gulf more? He's made quite a few trips.
Well, he has made exactly. He's learned from the Bush mistakes, but again, it seems like he can't catch a break on it. Mm-hmm. There's really nothing that much the government can do. And all the people who hate the government now say, well, the government should be doing more. So he can't seem to catch a break on this. And I think, look, you know, the Democrats seem to be in trouble anyway for a lot of reasons. We opened up the segment by talking about the unemployment numbers. And while that number is down, the fact is like 600,000, 650,000 people are no longer looking for work. The job market is not attractive. And ultimately, that's what's going to decide what's going to happen in November. And right now, it looks like the Democrats are heading for some pretty serious losses.
Right. People are mentioning phrases like double dip recession and jobless recovery. Of course, we knew that the jobs would be the last thing to come in the recovery, but still disappointing numbers today. Ken Rudin, NPR's political junkie, it's just wonderful to have you here. Thanks so much.
Robin, thank you for having me.
And have a wonderful 4th.
You too.
Okay. Well, let's take a break. And the 4th is also a time for family reunions. Oh boy, wait till you hear how many are attending the couple we're going to look at. They're going to need, you know, more than one big ballroom, tell you that. We'll take a look at that, and then later we'll poke around in a garden, maybe have a good recipe for you to get away from some of the news headlines of the weekend and have a little respite. But take a minute break and be back with our reunions here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. The 4th of July is a time for family reunions. Let's check in with two, starting with the Henry family in Blue Ash, Ohio. It's been 15 years since they got together. Terry Henry Hayden is coordinating it, and attendees chip in to pay her because it's a lot of work. Terry, how many people are you expecting?
We expect about 150 people that have signed up, and, you know, there's always people that just show up. So I guess maybe between 150 and 200.
Oh, people that show up, you know, we want to come. Because what do you do at the reunion? Tell us some of the activities.
Tug of war, softball, volleyball, horseshoes. This year we have a clown coming in, and they're doing face painting for the kids. We have a raffle, bingo, card tournament.
And the mayor, we understand.
We're getting a proclamation from the city of Blue Ash.
To say what?
To say that Friday, July 2nd and Saturday, July 3rd, are Edward and Charity Henry Day.
And who are they?
They are the patriarch and matriarch of our family who moved to Hazelwood in 1898.
Wow. Now, we understand this is at least primarily an African-American family?
Yes.
And how much more important might this be? I mean, I've done stories in the past on African-American reunions, and there seems to be some import because in many cases, the families came from slave backgrounds. People didn't know their family, and so reunions became a little more important. I'm just wondering, is there something of import there to you?
My grandfather and my grandmother came from the South. Particularly, my grandmother came through the Underground Railroad. When they moved here, there was a changing of names, and we can't trace the family back before that. So it's very important for us to stay in touch with each other and learn all the new family members' names, since we're all spread out now.
Well, and we understand, too, that your family is grappling with something in particular. It'll be familiar to too many families, I think, but that this is the first family reunion in a few years because a young person died recently, and so there's also the feeling of wanting to get together to sort of heal that.
Right. One of our members of our family died at a rather young age, and he had a brother as well that passed away, and we got to thinking that, okay, we probably need to get together again because there's a full one or two generations that we don't know. And it kind of hits close to home because these are people that are around our age.
Yeah, so death reminds you of hurry up and get living.
Right, the importance of life and family.
Yeah. With that in mind, we also understand that there are closing ceremonies to the reunion. What happens there?
We will have a buffet dinner and give out awards like Family Spirit Award. We have about 10 graduates this year that we need to honor. And also to have the person who has the most stories is actually our keynote speaker. So he will give a speech about our ancestors, the ones we may not be aware of that he knew, so that we can carry the stories through the generation.
That's terrific. Well, Terry Henry Hayden, speaking about the Henry family reunion this weekend in Ohio. Thanks so much, and just have so much fun.
Thank you, and have a great 4th of July weekend.
Well, you too. And now let's turn to Chicago and a family celebrating its 82nd annual family reunion this weekend. We're joined by Pam Boyd, one member of the very large Rashid family. Pam, 82 years in a row. Have you gone to every... Well, you haven't. You're not 82, but...
No, I haven't.
Have you gone to all of them in your lifetime?
No, I didn't. I actually went to them up until I was probably about 10 or 11, then my parents moved to New Orleans, and we kind of fell out of it for a while. And about 8 years ago, they were holding it in Chicago, and my brother and I brought our children up here to find out about their family, and we've been attending it ever since.
Well, I understand it was your daughter starting to ask about family that got you to go back.
She was, you know, listening to us talk about, you know, we were children and the things that we would do at the reunion and seeing our cousins. So we brought her and my nieces and nephews, and I had some aunts who we hadn't seen people in years, and they walked up to us and said, "And who are you?" And they took us around, and we met as many people as we could in one day.
Yeah. Well, let's explain, because this isn't your average family get-together. It's large, about 300 people, but it's almost like a board meeting because we understand the family's gotten so big that it's registered with the IRS. It's a nonprofit.
We are registered. We have set up a constitution, and in our constitution, we have the purpose of why we get together. And one of the reasons we get together is to foster and promote close ties among our family members throughout the United States and Canada. We support our youth educational achievement awards that we give our children as they graduate and go on to college.
Right. I mean, there's a lot going on here. You look at the family finances. You give money to charitable organizations.
We do. They're very active with the St. Jude organization, and that's probably where most of our money gets donated to. Then we also, you know, we like to promote and encourage, you know, the future generations to continue understanding their ethnic heritage, their history, their background and traditions.
Well, and you know, I'm not surprised you contribute to St. Jude's. Marlo and Danny Thomas.
They're Lebanese.
Being Lebanese as well,
yeah.
And such a big part of St. Jude's Hospital. And I'm just wondering, obviously, that, you know, you're several generations Lebanese American at this point, but how much of this is about, you know, holding on to a little bit of that Lebanese heritage?
there's a lot of that in it. We make sure that we do a traditional dinner one night out of the weekend. They'll do their traditional little kind of a line dance and music, mm-hmm. and the kids enjoy that.
And you have your own website for the reunion, complete
yes,
with
do.
A place to register. So if there's Rashids listening, you can order T-shirts. What does this mean to the kids and the family in particular that they have this family reunion to participate in?
I think it means a lot to know where you come from and, where you're going. And not only that, but they have a network of people to help them. There are architects, there's engineers, teachers. So, we're able to mentor them and help them through life. And, it's kind of special.
Your family.
Yes, and you can count on them to help you.
And we understand in this economy, that's serious. People will be looking for jobs as they network with family members and eat baked goods and barbecued things.
Oh, my goodness, yes, the food. It's awesome.
Pam Boyd with the Rashid family celebrating their 82nd annual family reunion this weekend in Chicago. Pam Boyd, have a wonderful 4th.
Thank you. You too.
And by the way, we'll be here on the 5th. We'll check in on the Gulf, where that giant 10-story super tanker turned oil skimmer has arrived. Will it work? But that's on Monday. Latest news is next, here and now.
Support for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Hinckley, Allen & Snyder, where partners have been giving clients practical legal advice for over 100 years throughout New England and now including Connecticut, online at haslaw.com. And the Institute of Contemporary Art on the Boston waterfront. Discover the power and beauty of new art and ideas, icaboston.org.
What if you could take a test that would tell you whether you're a candidate to live to 100 or beyond? Researchers now say it's possible to devise such a test after a study of more than 1,000 centenarians identified a set of genetic variants that can predict long life 77% of the time. Boston University's Dr. Thomas Pearls is one of the lead authors of the study. Dr. Pearls, so tell us about your research, what you found.
So the New England Centenarian Study is the largest study of centenarians in the world, and we've been really enrolling these subjects way back since 1995. They're hard to find, a lot easier to find recently. And so we've really started to concentrate on even people 105 and older and people that we call super centenarians, 110 and older. And as we started to study these even older people, we really, looking at their families, got the sense that there was something very strongly genetically going on. So we proceeded with a genetic study to see what variations these folks have in common compared to the control population, and indeed found these 150 markers in the genome. They're across the whole genome that really do a good job as a group in differentiating centenarians from other people.
So you found that they all had this specific sort of genetic makeup that you attribute to long life. But what about other factors in long life? Did these same people then have an absence of genetic markers for the kind of illnesses that end life?
It's a really good question, because that's also a hypothesis that we've long held, that in order to get to extreme old age, you'd have to not have genetic variants that predispose to age-related diseases, while maybe even having some variants that protect you, what we call longevity-enabling variants. And to our surprise, when we did the study, when you counted up the number of known disease-associated variants from the literature in the centenarians and the controls, they actually had about the same number. And what really seems to make a difference in a person's having a genetic predisposition to very old age is the presence of these longevity-associated variants. They could be somehow protective. They could somehow trump or cancel the effect of disease-associated variants.
So if you had genetic variants for disease, Alzheimer's or maybe even cancer, you're saying these longevity genetic variants trump them?
Yes, or even if a person got such a disease, maybe it would delay the age of onset or made it easier to treat, for example.
So what do we do with this, Thomas Pearls? I mean, I'm already thinking, I'm sure listeners are, gee, do I want to find out if I have this?
I would say that it's very good news for people who have this predisposition, because centenarians, generally about 90% of them, avoid disability well into their 90s.
Couldn't there be some ethical questions? Couldn't a company, for instance, ask for gene testing, and if they think you're going to live and be productive to your 80s or 90s or 100s, and Oh, not want to pay your health benefits for that long, not hire you.
I couldn't agree with you more, Robin. And in fact, there's laws in place where genetic information cannot be used by insurance companies and others that involved in social entitlements. And I think that's very, very wise.
Do you worry that this science somewhere down the road could be co-opted by the very wealthy who could afford to buy some sort of gene splicing procedure and get the genes and monopolize old age?
I don't personally think that in my lifetime we'll be seeing technology where people based upon this information will do specific genetic engineering in a living human being to then somehow rearrange things to get them to extreme old age. What my sincere hope is that this information will generally lead to a better understanding of these longevity-associated variants and how they might translate into better protecting people from age-related diseases, particularly something like Alzheimer's disease, not to get a lot of people to be 100 or 110, but to help people delay their disease towards some kind of natural end to their lives, what they were kind of programmed to do. But the whole idea is to improve their quality of life for as long as possible prior to that death.
That's Thomas Pearls, Associate Professor of Medicine and Geriatrician at Boston Medical Center, one of the researchers who published a new study on the genetics of aging in the journal Science. You can take his life expectancy calculator, by the way, at our website, hereandnow.org. Dr. Pearls, thanks as always.
My pleasure, Robin. Thank you.
And by the way, quick note, Monday we're going to look at summer blockbusters, and a Coast Guard advisory reminded us of one. New Englanders are being warned to watch out for great white sharks this weekend. Jaws was set on the 4th of July weekend. Be careful. Back in 30 seconds, here and now. The chaos of combat in the new film Restrepo, which focuses on a platoon of American soldiers fighting in Afghanistan's Korangal Valley. Restrepo is the name they gave their remote hilltop base to honor their medic, Juan Restrepo, a 20-year-old single father killed in combat. In the film's first scene, he mugs for the camera as his platoon begins its journey.
Got him. Tune in next time where we're going to be still loving life and getting ready to go to war.
Loving life. The medic Juan Restrepo saves a lot of lives before being killed in the Korangal Valley. The film Restrepo, made by Sebastian Younger and Tim Hetherington, opens today in Boston and Chicago and other cities. You can see the schedule at hereandnow.org. We had Sebastian Younger here recently, and today Army Captain Dan Kearney, a father of two small boys who led Juan Restrepo's platoon, joins us. You know, Captain, I want to welcome you, but I can see, is it hard to hear Juan speaking knowing he's gone?
It's not really so much difficult as it is just kind of just takes me back and brings up other memories. But it's been a long time, and I've been deployed multiple times. So it's just there's a lot of guys like that, and I've kind of put him away in my own little place.
When you say a lot of guys like that, he was beloved. I mean, 20 years old, and we just heard that spirit, love and life, and then cut down. Do you mean a lot of guys with that spirit or a lot of guys who died?
A little bit of both. I mean, if you see the movie, you'll also hear about another incredibly well-loved man, Sergeant Larry Rugel, probably one of the best fighters that I've ever come across, a beloved single father as well. I mean, we lost seven guys out there.
Yeah. Well, and we have a little snippet of sound. Now, is it okay if I play it? Because this is after the death of Sergeant Larry Rugel, and it really hits the soldiers hard. Do you mind if we listen to that?
No, let's go ahead.
Yeah, let's listen to that.
That is Sergeant Rugel.
2-6, 2-6, 2-3.
You're lying, right, man?
I ain't lying. Why would I lie about something like that?
2-6, 2-3. Where'd he get hit? I got to see.
Yeah, that's about what you can say.
So where is this place you put that?
Good question. Probably a question my wife would like to know, too. It's a place I kind of just draw from. It helps me keep on going and allows me to do my job that much better because I have an appreciation for the loss of life and what it is I'm asking those men to do out there when I'm leading them. Sergeant Rugel is probably one of the harder guys that I lost, just because of how close I was to him and just how incredible a fighter and warrior he was. I'm not so sure where exactly I put it. I put it back someplace that I only talk about with the guys that I've gone over there with. It's almost like I was cheating on my wife and I married the other 200 guys that were out there with me.
Yeah.
And then when I came back, it was like I had a divorce myself from them. I think when somebody cheats on somebody or does something like that, they're not so willing to talk about it later on with their other spouse or their other loved ones.
Wow, what an incredible analogy. And for those who haven't yet read the book or seen the film, we talked to Sebastian Younger about this. It's an incredible camaraderie. You see this constant physical playing around like a bunch of pile of puppies.
Yeah, exactly.
You know? And at times, even, I mean, I remember one moment where a new top guy comes in, you know, a big deal, stuff on his shoulders guy. You know, you're quietly listening to him tell the unit what's going to happen, and then somebody says, let's get him. And you literally beat him up.
We indoctrinate him.
Yeah.
It's like brotherly love. I mean, two brothers, they roll around, they kind of establish who the alpha male is and who isn't. And the boys out there for 15 months, they just build this kind of family up together where the platoon leader's like the big brother, and he's not going to let anybody mess with his little brother. So he's out there to take care of him and kind of guide them in that way.
There was also another aspect of being at war that we saw so clearly, and it's hard for those who haven't, perhaps, to grasp this. Despite this pain that we're feeling again today and the loss, there's a rush. When asked what you were there for, a lot of the troops said, it's not about, we don't care what's happening in Washington. You're nodding yes. It's about what?
It's about the man to the left and the right. They don't fight for the red, white, and blue. They don't fight for America's values. They didn't sign up for all those reasons. They're fighting to make sure that it is the guy on the left, he makes it home on that mid-tour leave. So the guy on his right, he's going to turn 21 tomorrow. They want to make sure that he sees his 21st birthday and so that he can go back home and drink a beer with them. It's so that the kid behind him can go back and see his daughter. They've been bonded together by the blast furnace of combat. These men are truly one.
And I would think it would have to be that, because at the end of the day, 50 men, I believe, died in Corngill Valley.
Right.
In total. You said, what, seven?
Seven were from
your
battle company.
Your group. And the U.S. military decided to leave the valley, gave it up. And so if it were just about that valley, you'd be in trouble, I would think.
We'd have some problems.
Yeah. How do you feel about the fact that the policy shifted and they decided that they weren't going to try to take that valley after shedding so much blood there?
At the end of the day, I mean, going into the Corngill Valley was really meant to keep the enemy off their toes, to keep the balance off of a greater mission that was going on a much larger scale and on a much larger valley just to the north called the Pesh Valley, and allow the government to kind of gain a foothold into a place that it really had never gained a foothold in, and to kind of establish itself. So we were in the Corngill fighting and keeping the enemy so that they could do something better on the Pesh. And once they got the Pesh road, you know, paved and lights and a bank on the road and a few other things going in the right direction, I think they felt like we need to pull these guys out and put them someplace else so they can better used.
Well, I know I wanted to ask you about that, Captain, and we only have a few more minutes, but there's been a whole lot of policy changes in the last couple of weeks. There's been the General McChrystal switch off and the flare up there, and the talk about, you know, maybe there won't be the offensive in Kandahar that was planned for this summer. Maybe it'll be a rethinking of that. Maybe there won't be a withdrawal exactly in July of 2011. Maybe that'll just be the starting point. You know, this shifting sense. As a soldier, what do you think of that?
If Big Bird was in charge, and as long as he, you know, could do what was right, and he didn't ask us to compromise our integrity or our morals and our values, then I think we would go forth and we would do whatever it is that he asked. The shift is not going to change anything on the ground. Those guys don't worry about that. They care about the guy to the left and to the right that's going to go and possibly take that bullet for him so that he can go home, or he's worried about taking that bullet so that that guy can go home and see his wife, his girlfriend, or his daughter and son.
You've left me with an image, Big Bird in charge of the military. That's Army Captain Dan Kearney, one of the soldiers featured in the new film Restrepo. It opens today here in Boston and other cities. You can go find out more at our website, hereandnow.org. Captain Kearney, thank you so much for coming in, and best of luck to you.
Thank you.
Down the road.
I appreciate it.
Well, thoughts on this or anything on the program, you can always go to hereandnow.org, click on Contact Us to send an email, or you can scroll down and leave a comment right there, hereandnow.org. Back in a minute with a trip to Maine, here and now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world, uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Welcome back.
Soup's been simmering for about 15 minutes, and it's a gorgeous green color. The peas are done. Hello! Hi, come on in.
When we arrived at Here and Now Chef Kathy Gunst's home in Maine, she was already at work in the kitchen, videotaping a recipe for pea and lettuce soup.
I shelled like 2 pounds of peas from the garden and from a farm, and I made a broth from the pea shells with onions from the garden and garlic scapes. Look at these.
Garlic scapes? Well, we're here to find out what those are. And by the way, we'll have that recipe and the video of Kathy making it at our website, herenow.org. But we are here for a tour of her garden and home. Now, her kitchen is a working cook's dream, all skylights and a massive island, an add-on to the original house in the front. So this is the main house. How old is this?
We're not exactly sure, 1760, 1770, but the original colonial, the four rooms back here this way.
Wide board floors. These are low ceilings.
Low ceilings. John, tall husband John, barely makes it. This is now my office, but this is what would have been called the keeping room. Huge, 6 foot open, wide hearth, fireplace. And there would have been a fire going there back in 1700s, 1800s, 24/7.
Keeping room? What did that mean?
The keeping room, because this is where they spent all their time. This would have been the warmest room in the house, and it would have been the main center of activity.
Kathy compliments the original colonial owners for placing the house on a slight hill, so she never gets the first killing frost. She says her large garden outside is in the same exact spot it was in colonial days. It's been naturally fertilized for a couple hundred years, so she thinks that's why it grows so well. But we start our tour at the smaller garden that Kathy and her husband John planted right outside the kitchen door for easy picking and, as you'll hear, more natural fertilizer.
We built this just a few years ago, and it's protected by two sides of the house, so it almost has a microclimate. We literally grow fresh herbs, and sometimes we'll have cabbages or tomatoes up here, and we'll pick them in November.
I see basil, a couple types of basil.
Yep, chervil, sage, coriander, Italian parsley. The other thing about this location is if you look right up this chimney, there's a little hole up there, and there are about 40 bats living there.
Why?
So we have guana.
Which is good for fertilizer.
Excrement. It is amazing for fertilizer. Look at this tomato over here. It's coated in the guana, and it's growing twice as big as everything else because you see all that, those little pellets? That's the bat guana, and people pay money for this stuff. This is all woods back here, and there's this strange beaver pond.
What is that?
This is a beaver pond. We had always wanted to put a pond in here, and everyone told us we couldn't do it, and these beavers came. And they have eaten the trees, as you can see, and it's coated in pollen, and it's like a vernal pool. There's no fish in there, but there's frogs and turtles, and we've had great blue herons back there. It's a very interesting, bizarre environment. Right now, I think it looks like the setting of a Stephen King movie.
And we're in Maine.
That's right.
Perfect.
It's just creepy looking right now.
So let's go out to the larger garden area.
Yep. These are mostly perennials, but I have a whole bunch of edible flowers. I have calendula. We have lavender everywhere. But this is where the vegetable garden starts.
Now, if somebody's just starting a basic garden, what would you say as a cook would be the things you'd want to have in a very basic starter garden?
You want to have things that are going to be quick rewards so that you stay interested. Radishes grow literally overnight. Spinach grows very quickly and it's very rewarding because you can eat it raw in salads. You can make soups with it. Certain greens like arugula, greens that are expensive to buy, they're so easy to grow and you'll feel like, wow, that was just $10 of arugula we had. And it keeps growing. You can pick it and it will keep repeating all summer long.
What's hard and you wouldn't recommend?
We don't do corn anymore, and we don't do potatoes because so many people around here grow that, and the bugs on the potato plants, you have to keep up with them on a daily basis. And corn also, we have about 3 corn farms within 5 miles, and it takes up a lot of space. All right, so here are the peas. These are the English or shelling peas, and that's what we use to make the soup. Let me pick you some.
Yeah, yeah.
These are really big.
Wow. Can we just eat them
now?
Yeah,
of course. So this is what I did for the soup, is you just open the shell. The peas are used for the soup, and the shell was used to make a kind of a fresh pea broth.
Oh, man, that is good.
I know. There's nothing like it. There you go.
Oh, we're just eating them straight out of the pod.
And then over here, we have snap peas. Let me pick a few of those for you. And these are the ones that you don't shell, that you just eat the whole pod and everything. These are great for stir fries. They're great in salad. Here they are. They're hiding.
Oh, yeah.
Just eat that straight.
Oh.
It's so peaceful in here. And for me to watch food coming every day, it changes every day. It's interesting. And if you don't have a plot of land, you can put pots outside an apartment on a windowsill, on a fire escape, and throw a few tomatoes in and throw some basil in.
Can you do peas and things in a pot?
I've seen people do peas in pots. You need a trellis because they're climbers. Mm-hmm. They want to go up. You see, I just have string attached to two old sticks, and yeah, that's all you need. It's not complicated. I have about four types of eggplant and sweet peppers and chili peppers in this row. Mm. And this thin green you see next to it, those are leeks. That's one of my favorite things to grow. You know, leeks are so expensive, and I literally planted, I don't know, I have a few rows.
30 there.
Yeah, exactly.
And what will you use those for, soups and things?
Soups, the basis of a stew, anything.
Okay.
What else? Broccoli's really close. Big zucchinis and pumpkins going down there. And green beans, French green beans over there. What else do we have? This is my garlic. I planted this in the fall. I have about 80 garlic plants here. And at the top of them, let's come over here. Oh. It's the top of the garlic. This is called a garlic scape. And they have this fabulous curly Q shape with a little bulb right here. I'll cut it open and you can smell it. These are like little seeds.
Oh, wow.
And you chop this into salad dressings. We put it into the soup. You can garnish things with it. You can cook it almost like garlic and a scallion combined.
Yeah.
It really, so
powerful smell.
What happens is that, see how beautiful? They're all like elegantly curled at the top of the garlic. And once it straightens upright at the top of the plant, you have to pick them off because they drain energy from the garlic bulbs, which are growing underground. And we'll harvest those late August, early September.
And as you say, the garlic bulb is underneath.
Right, and they're called scapes. And if you ask for them at farmer's market, they're really plentiful right now. And they sell for about a quarter. And I'm going to tell you, for a quarter, you can't find more flavor.
Now, you know, being up here in Maine and in Massachusetts and across the country, when people have gardens and they're huge like this, you end up having surplus. Do you do the thing where you put the table out with maybe an old coffee can if somebody wants to take stuff?
Or... That's the story of zucchini. Up and down the streets, there's little signs with piles of baseball-sized zucchini with signs, take me, please. I do a lot of canning and freezing, so if I have an excess of something, I tend to make a big pot of soup and throw that in the freezer. And I try to plant in intervals instead of putting in six zucchini plants on the same day. Put in a few zucchini plants, and then 3 weeks later, put in another one. So when that first batch of zucchini is finished, you're going to get a whole new crop again and be excited about seeing it. That way you don't get this glut of everything ripening at the same time.
We finished our day back in Kathy's kitchen to sample some of that fresh from her garden pea soup, as she said, using the pea shells instead of bacon for a base. Ingenious and delicious. We'll have the recipe and video at our website, hereandnow.org, along with Kathy's tips for five essentials for the summer pantry. Boy, some days this job is so wearing. Thanks to Emiko Tamagawa, who produced our piece, and Jesse Costa, who produced our Web Extra recipe video. Here and Now is also a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Cue the prerequisite music. Have a great weekend, a safe 4th of July, and please join us. We'll be here Monday, Here and Now.